Welcome to Sounding Off with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Be sure and sign up for our weekly newsletter. That's where you get the first look at all of our upcoming guests, as well as our most recent podcasts and our most recent op-eds. And we'd appreciate it if you would go over to Facebook and give us a like as well. In studio with me is my friend Stephen Peck. It's great to have you here.
Hey, good morning, Kim. Thanks for having me back.
And there's some new things that just happened in your life, right?
Well, there are. I'm back in the Navy Reserves. I'm serving as a Lieutenant Commander in the Medical Service Corps. I haven't drilled yet, but
You're in the Navy.
I'm back in the Navy. Yes.
Well, thank you for your service. And you know, I have this other show that I do, America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson, and I've interviewed over 140 World War II veterans and adding in, you know, other wars and conflicts. And one of the guys, a Vietnam veteran, said people are now coming up to him and saying, thank you for your service. And he responds to them, he says, just say thank you for my freedom. And I thought, oh, I really like that. So thank you for my freedom.
Oh, I appreciate that. It's sometimes awkward because you don't know what to say. So I always say back, you know, I appreciate your support, and it's an honor to serve such a magnificent country.
And it is, and we've got a country that is worth fighting for, Stephen Peck. And so what we're going to talk about today is, you said that you're very concerned about kind of this inflection point that we're at right now. So explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, when I last time we talked on your show, we were talking about COVID and masking, but I think there's a larger framework that we have to look at the whole summer and, you know, starting back 6 months ago and say, well, how can we explain this and what's going on in the culture here? And I think there are a couple of thunderclap moments that we might have missed. And they're not obvious when they happen, but these are seismic cultural and political realignments that I think that we can look back at 60 days later, 90 days later and say, I think something's happening here. And it should be alarming, and certainly worth talking about.
Okay. So what is it? What do you think is one of these thunderclap moments?
Well, the thunderclap moments are, just to highlight, and then we'll get into the details here, the resignation or the firing of James Bennett from he was an editor at the New York Times, a person that is a self-described liberal, but somebody who believes that all viewpoints in an open society are valid. What we're seeing now with his removal and basically the changing of the guard at the New York Times is a delegitimization of certain viewpoints. And so
what happened with that? Why was he fired?
Sure. Well, the backstory is there was a Senator Tom Cotton, who's a senator from the state of Arkansas, former Army captain, served in Afghanistan in a combat role, a JD at Harvard, wrote a piece in the New York Times as an op-ed piece in June. And he was calling for federal troops to be put into place in the cities to quell some of the violence. And I have a couple of, I'd like to read a section of his op-ed to just give the listeners an idea of what it is that we're talking about here. And this is, you know, this was a short piece. And so this is just an excerpt from that short piece. It says, this is Tom Cotton here, but the rioting has nothing to do with George Floyd, whose bereaved relatives have condemned the violence. On the contrary, nihilistic criminals are simply out to loot and for the thrill of destruction, with cadres of left-wing radicals like Antifa infiltrating protest marches to exploit Floyd's death for their own anarchic purposes. These rioters, if not subdued, not only will destroy the livelihoods of law-abiding citizens, but will also take more innocent lives. Many more poor communities still bear the scars from past upheavals will be set back still further. One thing above all else will restore order in our streets, which is an overwhelming show of force to disperse, detain, and ultimately deter lawbreakers. But local law enforcement in some cities desperately needs backup, while delusional politicians in other cities refuse to do what's necessary to uphold the rule of law. The pace of the looting and the disorder may fluctuate from night to night, but it's past time to support local law enforcement with federal authority, and some governors have mobilized the National Guard, yet others refuse, and in some cases, the rioters still outnumber the police and the Guard combined. So this is not a controversial standpoint. I mean, we have a real crisis in many of our major cities, It's not just the destruction of property, it's the destruction of life.
We're seeing people being killed.
Right. The reaction to this, and I invite your listeners to Google it for or DuckDuckGo it. So I just call it get duck it. Tom Cotton, Send in the Troops is the title. This was written on June 3rd of this year. Again, okay. this is recent. There's now, I mean, take a look. There's a whole basically it's a trigger warning that says, hey, look, this piece caused so much controversy. We've had to massage and kind of explain and caveat why we did what we did. But ultimately, inside the New York Times and from the readership of the New York Times, they demanded the dismissal and firing of James Bennett, who is the editor of the New York Times. And this is supposedly the crown jewel of
journalism.
Right, right. Now, for us on the right, I haven't taken the New York Times seriously for a long time.
Me neither.
But for those that are mainstream liberals, this is, quote unquote, the journal of record. And what I think is important to point out is that a guy like James Bennett no longer has standing in an institution like the New York Times.
And that really is a thunderclap moment if we really think about that, because classic liberalism or liberalism is all viewpoints would come to the table and yes. You kind of duke it out in the battle of ideas. But now they no longer want to do that. And that is a very dangerous place to go.
So I think that's such an important point, and it's one I invite your listeners and you to not use the word liberal. Dennis Prager has made this point. He does not, I mean, he uses the word liberal, but he, when he refers to the left, he talks about the left. And the left is distinct from liberals because in the historical sense of the word liberal, classical liberalism, the ideas of the Enlightenment are things like equity or equality and rights and consent and tolerance, free exchange of ideas,
yeah, exactly.
Right? That you're free to say things that are controversial. In fact, those controversial things are the things that deserve the most protecting. And you don't have to agree with us, or you and I don't have to see eye to eye and everything, but we should be allowed to sort out our differences in a through speech and writing. And if you can't sort out your political disagreements through speech and writing in the ballot box, then what tools are left to you? And that's when things get really dangerous. And just on the 25th, I think we're recording this on the 27th. Mm-hmm. On the 25th, former vice presidential nominee Hillary Clinton said on Showtime that Joe Biden should not concede the president the election under any circumstances. Under any circumstances. So she's the attempt to delegitimize an election is happening 80 days before the first ballots are cast. So if elections are delegitimized, if ideas are delegitimized, if speakers are no longer welcome on campuses, how is that in keeping with the traditional understanding of liberalism? And so in that sense, I consider myself a liberal. I think you're a liberal. Obviously, that's not in our current vocabulary, mm-hmm. but I think it's time for liberals, traditional liberals, that might be pro-labor, join forces with people on the right, because the risk of the radicals taking over not just the New York Times, but larger institutions is real.
And the country.
It's very real.
Do you not find it interesting, Stephen Peck, that in the mainstream media, you're seeing this narrative that Donald Trump will not leave the White House and that they will use force to take him out of the White House. But yet over here they're saying to Joe Biden, do not concede the election in any way. They, you know, it's so interesting to me. If anybody, people need to be paying attention to this.
I think it is, and I think to a certain extent it's projection is what it is. And what I mean by projection, I'm not a psychologist, but it's a term from psychology that basically says you apply to your opponent's views and values you hold yourself. So when they're saying that he won't leave office, they're really – that's a confession, a public confession of their motives to a certain extent.
That they won't leave office.
They plan to look, I mean, anybody that's paying attention to what's going on here, and this is all available on YouTube. You can put it in your show notes. I'm happy to share it with you. This is not fake news. This is on Showtime. Showtime. Hillary Clinton saying, we're hiring lawyers. We're getting ready to challenge this. They're looking at, remember in 2000 when the disaster that Florida was? Now imagine a nationwide version of that. I certainly think it's in the cards. I think they'd like to create, even if Donald Trump wins, enough disunity that they would undermine his authority and his legitimacy. That's what this is about, is undermines somebody's legitimacy and relegating you to a political corner, putting a dunce hat on you and saying, look at this person. They are not worthy of serious consideration. Their views are so far out the mainstream that we can't take them seriously.
Speaking of that, I saw, or somebody told me about a meme that they recently saw regarding the presidential election. And they said, you're voting for Joe Biden. Tell me why. One reason that doesn't include the name Trump.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, I have friends on the left. Nobody's actually inspired by Joe Biden. The Joe Biden supporters that are out there are usually, it's more of an anti-Trump vote mm-hmm. than it is a pro-Biden vote. And everybody can see that he's in clear cognitive decline. I'm not sure how people square that circle, but their vitriol for Trump is intense enough that it doesn't matter.
And, you know, I really don't understand that, because if you look at the policies of what has been going on, the you know, cutting back on rules and regulations, lowering taxes, and Jason McBride with Presidential Wealth Management, one of my valued sponsors, had actually done an apples-to-apples comparison from 2017 to 2019. Everyday hardworking people had a lot more money in their pocket because the federal government took less. Now, the state of Colorado took a little bit more, but people had a lot more money in their pocket. So when they say that the Trump tax cuts were for millionaires and billionaires, yeah. It's just not true, Stephen Peck.
No, it's not. I had a conversation actually as recently as this past weekend, and they're friends of mine that are center left, and they said, can you explain, you know, is this a vote for Trump that you're making, or is this the lesser of two evils? And I said, it's a vote for Trump. I'm enthusiastic about, I have a Trump flag flying off my house. I've door knocked for Donald Trump. I invite other people to do the same. And he said, can you explain your support for Donald Trump without talking about the economy? Okay, so that's how they put their it's like, well, that's a concession on their point. But yeah, I'm happy to talk about why you should support Donald Trump if you're not talking about the economy. But I'm not sure why it's illegitimate. I mean, for decades, we've been told that we have to look out for the little guy, for the underclass, for the minority, for the new immigrant. And under in the 3.5 years that we've had a Trump presidency, which is not very long, it's not very long at all, we've seen not just the stock market go up for people that are part of that, but we've seen wage growth at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. So,
and organic, not forced wage growth. Organic.
That's right. Right. This isn't. Are you suggesting talking about minimum wage?
Yeah,
laws.
Exactly.
Right. No. These are business owners that now have more liquidity that are able to reward their hardworking employees with higher wages, because when you have 3.5% unemployment rate, you have to be competitive on things like wages. And so that does lift all tides. But he said, can you talk about Trump without talking about the economy? I said, happily, let's talk about it.
So what'd you say?
Well, there's a laundry list, and I'll see if I can do it from memory here, but just click through them quickly. I mean, we had a NAFTA agreement that everybody said could never be renegotiated. That's here to say, well, he got it renegotiated, and now it's a better deal for American workers. Okay, NATO, our NATO allies in Europe have not been paying their fair 2% for decades. 2% is what is owed as far as
that's the agreement we had.
Exactly. He said, you guys have been living in the shade of our protection. You need to pony up. And then what we see with the
they did, right?
Right. Yes, they have. Now, I think Germany is still dragging their feet. I don't know if they're quite up to 2%, but we've seen movement in the right direction. And the Paris Accords were invalidated, which were just a redistribution crock. You saw the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was building steam and never put into place, that fell apart. He got rid of that. Judges, not just the Supreme Court judges, but the circuit court judges, which are, and the federal judges across the country. What's happened with the realignment in with the Sunni Gulf states and the Shiites in Iran. Now, all of a sudden, the UAE, Oman are making unprecedented once-in-a-generation deals with Israel. So we were promised World War III at the beginning. Remember, he was not going to finish his term. This was all going to be a catastrophe. This is a big marketing ploy. He was going to some – I'm not saying these are mainstream views, but there were even people saying he'll set up concentration camps. I mean, ridiculous stuff that never came true. And in fact, we've had more peace than we've had in a long time. And so I think there's – we talk about energy independence. We haven't had that. And he was able to provide that. And it was well beyond the Keystone Pipeline. It was just about getting stuff done. And he has delivered. The campaign has promises.
Promises made, promises kept.
Right. Which I think, you know, for many jaded Americans, it's like, well, here's another politician. I don't really show up to vote. Why should I care? He's just going to let us down. Look. The president's not a perfect man. I don't know anybody.
I'm not either.
Neither am I.
I have things that I would not want trumpeted everywhere, you know?
Yes, right. Okay, he is not either. And he's a flawed person.
All of us.
But please don't, I reject the idea that some uncouth tweets invalidate his record of success. I mean, give me a break. Give me a break.
On that note, I want to just encourage that people vote, and every vote is going to count. And in past elections, we've had many Christians, many veterans that have not voted. It's beyond me, Stephen Peck, to think about veterans that have been willing to put their lives on the line for this country. And then doing just the easy thing of voting for Trump, voting for Republicans this election cycle. You may not love them, but we need to I see the choice is so clear. It's divisiveness and destruction.
Right.
Or it is the American dream of all men are created equal, a life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, prosperity, unity.
Right.
Those are the questions. And so it is important that people vote Republican, and then stay engaged, do their civic duty. And if for some reason they don't agree with a stand that their representative that they've elected makes, have a conversation with them. That is our duty to do as Americans.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I agree with you that the contrast is stark. I mean, I think the last time we had a contrast election like this one was probably 2008 in my estimation. Actually, 2016. I don't think anybody expected Donald Trump to actually win, but he did. And imagine what the country would look like today if she had one. You're right. It is discouraging and sometimes bewildering to think, okay, on the one hand, you have a drumbeat that this is a racist, misogynistic, xenophobic, nativist place. It's a rotten place to be, right? That's the message that we continuously hear.
From the Democrats, yep.
Yes, right. It's this just terrible place to be. But apparently, as awful as it is, we still want new people to come here.
Well, they want to come here.
Well, right, of course, and they should be allowed to legally through the proper path. But there's an incongruence with the message. If this is such a rotten place, why do you want all the people from overseas and other countries to come to?
Interesting point. Okay.
There's systemic racism everywhere. There's sexist hiding behind every tree. Why in the world would you want to
bring more people here?
Well, yeah, save them. Save them from this awful place and make sure that they never come here because it's so terrible.
I hadn't thought about that message. That's a good one.
So. Well, I mean, I'm just putting two and two together. I'm not sure why we want to, all those poor people in, unfortunate folks from around the world. We should save them. Let them know what a terrible place this is. I mean, ultimately, it's not an inspiring message, and I don't think it will prevail. Donald Trump's message of unity, of prosperity and optimism. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is consistently good. For anybody that's listening, he's consistently good on, I mean, his State of the Union address. I have to say, I mean, maybe I'm just drinking the Kool-Aid here, but I was inspired by
it. I was inspired by it as well.
The stories were inspirational, and they weren't just from the distant past. They were about current heroes that are that are stepping up and living out the American dream in courageous and unexpected ways. So I
was that not amazing at the RNC? I don't know if you saw that. This black man who was serving time in prison and came to know Christ and has gotten out of prison, became best friends with the agent that actually was instrumental in him being convicted and going to prison. And this guy, I wish I could remember his name, but
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, then when he got out of prison, he said he was going to make a difference. And he has started a program for people that are getting out of prison to, you know, get them educated and get them into jobs. And it's super inspiring.
Yeah.
So President Trump actually spoke at their graduation. I think there was 29 people that graduated a program, and President Trump went to that. And he stayed and shook the hands of each one of these people that, again, they'd been in prison, been in the system.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, making better choices.
Very cool.
So, but at the RNC, what Trump did is this black gentleman didn't realize it. Trump pardoned him.
Oh, wow.
And so he and the agent were both there and made comments as well. I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
That is very cool.
There is no way you can call him a racist when he does this. It's amazing.
It's such a ridiculous charge. And honestly, I kind of roll my eyes when I hear it now. It's so patently false. I mean, if you look, we were talking about his list of accomplishments, and I couldn't remember them all. But as we're talking about your story here that I missed, I also think about what he's done specifically for the black community in just these 3 years. It's been criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. He's created opportunity zones. He's an advocate for school choice, which is the civil rights issue of our era.
I
have such a passion for this topic of school choice because with education, it opens doors that would otherwise be closed. So if you're a single parent family in the inner city or in a rural community, it doesn't matter. If you're a single parent family and you're locked into your zip code and unable to give your kid a better chance with a better school, I mean, how many options do you really have? But school choice changes that. School choice says, you know what? You aren't a prisoner to your zip code. So even if you're a person at the lower spectrum of the wage spectrum, you still have an opportunity to share the hope of an adequate or even exceptional education with your child.
And that should really be our goal. And so Donald Trump, this has been amazing. He's saying federal tax dollars that go into education should follow the child.
Yes.
So that helps. I've just been thinking about Chicago, Steve Peck, and all the violence there, and you know, young people being killed. I think about a mom. Okay, it's Friday. It's Friday night. Mm-hmm. How am I going to keep my kids safe?
It's Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. How can I get out of this? How can I get out of this neighborhood? I want my kids to get out of this neighborhood, and they can't.
Well, that's why, I mean, I can't say for certain how official or scientific some of these. I've seen numbers that cite support for black for police in black communities is significantly higher than most believe. And I remember watching a video. It was a New York City video, and it was just a melee in the middle of the street, and the cops in their SUVs were putting the cars in reverse, and just it looked like hundreds of things being thrown at these cop cars in between all these apartment buildings and towers. And I thought to myself, somewhere there's somebody in the third floor of that neighborhood looking down at this disaster and saying, what is going on? And they feel you have to believe they feel unsafe.
Oh my gosh,
do you think that person, I mean, this is not a racial issue. This is just the human being issue. Do you really think that person is going to say, yeah, let me continue to defund the police? Because in Chicago, Mayor Lightfoot has her own personal security detail outside of her house.
From the police department.
It's the height of hypocrisy. Unfortunately, it's something that I've gotten used to. I don't know that people that don't listen to alternative media actually know this. I think their heads are still stuck in dinosaur media, where they believe all the things that come out of CNN or the New York Times, which is no longer, I mean, to loop it back here some,
yeah, let's
do. is no longer a place where traditional liberal, and again, this is center left. I'm not talking about liberal in the Enlightenment sense. I am and I'm not. Enlightenment liberalism includes both people on the modern right and the modern left. What I'm talking about is the hard left, the neo-Marxist left. And I think that they have made a a move for hegemony in our, some of our major institutions. One of them is the New York Times, which I think was, again, a thunderclap moment, and I can substantiate that with another document here. And then at Princeton University. But before we get to Princeton.
Okay.
Mary Wise, I think this is how you pronounce her name, another editor for the New York Times, wrote an open letter. And if your readers have not read this letter, it is so compelling. It should be read by everybody. And honestly, seriously, listen to what she has to say. She wrote this letter to the owner of the New York Times, and this is right after James Bennett's firing. She said, "It's with sadness that I write to tell you that I'm resigning from the New York Times." And I'm skipping down here a little bit. Twitter is not on the masthead of the New York Times, but Twitter's become its ultimate editor. As the ethics and mores of the platform have become those of the paper itself has increasingly become a kind of performance space. Stories are told, chosen and told in a way to satisfy the narrowest of audiences rather than to allow a curious public to read about the world and then draw their own conclusions. I was always taught that journalists are charged with writing the first rough draft of history. Now, history itself is one more ephemeral thing molded to fit the needs of a predetermined narrative. Isn't that damaging? Yes. I mean, it's just one punch after another. My own foray into wrongthink, we talked about that last show. My own forays into wrongthink have made me the subject of constant bullying by colleagues who disagree with my views. They've called me a Nazi and a racist. This is a person that describes herself as centrist or center left. I've learned to brush off comments about how I'm, quote, writing about the Jews again. Several colleagues perceived to be friendly with me were badgered by coworkers. My work and my character were openly demeaned on company-wide Slack channels where masthead editors regularly weighed in. There, some coworkers insisted that I needed to be rooted out of the company to be truly inclusive, to be a truly inclusive one, while others post act emojis next to my name. Still, other New York Times employees publicly smear me as a liar and as a bigot on Twitter with no fear that harassing me will be met with the appropriate action, and they never are. There are terms for all of this: unlawful discrimination, hostile work environment, constructive discharge. I'm no legal expert, but I know that this is wrong. I do not understand how you have allowed this kind of behavior to go on inside your company in full view of the paper's entire staff and the public. And I certainly can't square how you and other Times leaders have stood by while simultaneously praising me in private for my courage. Showing up for work as a centrist in American newspaper should not require bravery. Part of me wishes I could say my experience was unique, but the truth is that intellectual curiosity, let alone list-taking, is now a liability at the Times. Why edit something challenging to our readers or write something bold only to go through the numbing process of making it ideologically kosher when we can assure ourselves of job security and clicks by publishing our 4,000th op-ed arguing that Donald Trump is a unique danger to the country and the world? And so self-censorship has become the norm. I mean, this goes on and on. I could keep reading, and it's all compelling stuff. Your readers really ought to take a look at it. The point here is, center-left views are no longer welcome in the New York Times. And while you and I haven't read the New York Times for a long time because we've known this, I mean, many millions still take them seriously. And so the question, I think, is, will they now lose readership because they've become radicalized? Or will this now continue to influence the culture and push it further to the left?
That is going to be the real question. I will tell you, Stephen Peck, as you mentioned that, though, over the years, they said people in polite company, you probably don't remember this, but don't talk about religion or politics. Ugh. And I'm kind of like, what else is there? I mean, those are the things that we, you know, that make us alive to talk about that. And then, so, you know, people would say, we agree we don't talk about politics. And you know what? I'm not up for that anymore.
Neither.
That is self-censorship.
It is. I don't know. Maybe you know when that started, but I've only known that paradigm. And
it was in the 70s.
But I think that has, like, I don't know if there's pernicious motives behind that or not, but
I do. I think it is. They've been playing long ball, you know, tenureship for professors.
Right.
You know, and now that there's all this tenure in our universities.
Well,
Okay. You can't get rid of some of these radical professors, and then they also come to the state and they want more money for higher education, or you have your donors that graduated and have continued to fund that. Charlie Kirk over at Turning Point, they've started a new thing where they are starting to encourage that donors no longer fund these institutions that are indoctrinating kids and producing these kids that are out there destroying our neighborhoods, and to not fund that anymore. I think it's a brilliant idea.
I actually completely and wholeheartedly agree. I guess I do take exception with one thing I that you mentioned, which is tenure with professorships. I do support that. The reasoning behind that is professors need to be able to take on controversial topics and feel like, hey, if I do research on this topic, I'm not going to get blowback that will get me fired, right? But what's actually happening is it's so easy to get canceled, so easy for your views to be legitimized. The university was supposed to be this area where you can talk about crazy ideas, wacky ideas, controversial ideas, iconoclastic things. Now, all of a sudden, it's become they're seminaries of leftism where groupthink is the predominant theme, and it's in
But you can't get rid of those professors now because of tenure.
I agree with that. I guess I would have to think more about why or what to do about that. I mean, there are some schools I just wouldn't send my kids to. I just wouldn't. I think that they're frankly, I think they're dangerous. They're ideologically dangerous places. And I think a lot of parents think back on their own a university experience, and they'll say, well, you know, of course we had it was predominantly Democrats or quote unquote liberals. Okay.
But that was a different liberal.
It is not the same. Mm-hmm. It is not the same era. And in fact, this goes well beyond the university. It's now dipping down into high school, middle school,
and elementary school
pretty regularly. Yeah. So, I'm very up to speed on what's happening here in Douglas County. And there's specific examples I could share, but that would probably be sidetracked.
We'll do another podcast on that. So,
but I do want it to point out. So in that letter, that was that open letter that I just read from, that was addressed to the owner of the
Barry Weiss. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It was interesting that Sulzberger, which is the owner of the Times, said in a note to his staff, this is in response to the original Bennett firing. He said that none of these changes mark a retreat from the Times' responsibility to help people understand a range of voices across the breadth of public debate. The role is as important as it's ever been. We are a polarized nation whose shared understanding of the world has fractured. The Times and journalism more broadly plays an essential role in making sense of this moment, wrestling with the history that has brought us here and helping the public chart a path forward. I mean, talk about phony baloney.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
But people see that and they go, oh yeah, that's what they're about. So let's move over to, then you had another example, and I think that was Princeton, right?
Yeah, and I think it is Princeton, and they cited an open letter, some sort of document that basically, it's a declaration of I'm not sure what they titled it, but basically it's the letter begins with the following blunt sentence: anti-blackness is foundational to America. And it says Princeton University faculty letter calls for eliminating academic freedom via a committee that would review all publications for racist thought. So they're basically walking away from the idea that the university is the citadel of free exchange of controversial ideas. They're now saying that that is too risky. They're delegitimizing ideas that are not congruent with their worldview. And so it's becoming narrower and narrower and narrower. And the issue is not just what happens at Princeton. This is those professors graduate classes every single year, and those students move out into the newsrooms. They move out to the boardrooms. They move out into churches. They move out to philanthropic organizations, and now they're culturally dominant. And what I'm calling for is a union. I think we really need. I mean, I don't have a platform, but I guess I have. I'm happy to be on your shore, but what I think we need to see is more consideration for people with center left ideas to push back on the most radical elements, because if they can do this to a university or if they can do this to a newspaper, they can do it to a political party. And my fear is the AOC wing of the Democratic Party could become or has become dominant. I think
it's pulling Biden,
right?
And Kamala is a very very kind of radical activist left. So it's here, Stephen Peck. It is here. The decision, the time for choosing is here.
It is. It is. And for those that haven't been in university in some time, I went and just did a Google search in advance of this show to find out, like, who are some of the people that are getting canceled? Because I think that's where the delegitimizing starts. This is just a Google duck search that anybody can look up. This is the 2016-2017 academic school year. And this is not this is not exhaustive lifts. This is just a sampling. You had Milo canceled at Berkeley. Charles Murray canceled at Middlebury. I think his car was attacked. Heather McDonald at Claremont. Ann Coulter at Berkeley. Benjamin Netanyahu at Georgetown. Betsy DeVos at Cookman University. Danny Dannon, who's a Israeli UN ambassador at Columbia. Robert Spencer, who's a writer, canceled at University of Buffalo. David Horowitz at Berkeley. There was an ICE officer who was doing a presentation in sociology class. Demonstrators from various student organizations explicitly rejected the idea that any dialogue with ICE should be rejected because it would legitimize them. And then Ben Shapiro at the University of Wisconsin. All these have sub-stories that could fill up an entire show. And this is just one academic year.
What happened to diversity of ideas?
No, they don't exist. They really don't. I mean, that's why if you're sending junior off to your freshman year, expect them to come back with a very different worldview. I mean, this is not, I don't think this is new information, but
I'm not sure that people, we're having a kind of a reset now, I think, on education. And I'm not sure that people are looking at it and saying junior needs to go to college. I mean, my gosh, come out with all this debt.
Right.
And then not be able to get a job to take care of yourself.
Right.
I mean, the trades, just think about it. Through this whole COVID-19 thing, what was essential? We had an electrical problem.
Yes.
It was great to have an electrician. We had a plumbing problem. It was great to have a plumber. They were busy.
My AC kicked the bucket and the HVAC guy came out and I was really glad that he was there. But no, I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of people. I mean, I'm 37. So
you're a millennial.
I'm a millennial. Yeah. And I'm part of the cohort that has a student debt I'm still working to pay off, which really stinks. And do I wish I could turn back the clock and do things differently? Oh yeah, you bet I do. I mean, on the one hand, it has afforded me opportunities that I don't think I would otherwise have, but there are many paths forward here in our country. And I just don't think, I really implore people to think critically about where they're sending their kids to school. And if you think, oh, well, I'm sending them to a private school, that doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. And it really doesn't even matter if it's a math or art class. It might not have anything to do with politics, but politics is now so dominant on campus that we can turn art class into some sort of critical race theory discussion.
That's for sure. So I think some people know this about me because I have mentioned this, but I have one semester of college. But I have always been a voracious reader. And in a way, I think somebody said, I know I can't remember who it was, but a conservative said that how he became a conservative by graduating from college is that he drank so much beer during college, he missed class, and that's how he remained a conservative. I'm not sure I would recommend that strategy. I think probably reading and all is important, but I think there's going to be a big reset on a whole bunch of things, which I find as a positive on this COVID-19 Wuhan virus thing.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's going to be some of this will be people waking up and realizing, hold on here, the cost benefit, the return on investment no longer makes sense for the degree that I'm interested in. But I also think that there's probably structural realignment that will just impose itself. There's inertia that's underway that's just going to, it's just going to happen. If all of a sudden you're taking online classes, right, this fall, and you're thinking, okay, I don't want to do this, but hey, I didn't, for whatever reason, feel comfortable taking a gap year, and most of your experience is online, or even a portion of it's online, how long will it be before people say, well, if I'm going to take it online, why am I taking it from this professor without notoriety? He's just an obscure guy in my community. it will soon, I think it will soon morph into, I think they're called MOOTs or massive online something. They're basically a class where somebody of...
So there'll be competition.
There'll be competition. I think there already is, but I think this is going to continue to evolve over the coming years. Where all of a sudden it's like, if I'm going to be online, I could take a class from the top thinker in my field. And then all of a sudden, you know, whether it's sociology or archaeology or architecture, now you're hearing from the preeminent thought leader in that field. And you can do it from Colorado Springs, or you can do it from Greeley.
Or you could do it by living out in the Eastern Plains.
That's right.
You know, where housing is very affordable and the communities are safer and all kinds of things like that.
Why am I obligated now to you know, move to Lawrence, Kansas or Boulder, Colorado? You don't have to do that anymore.
That is absolutely fascinating. So, hey, Stephen Peck, we're just about out of time. I think we covered, this has been fascinating.
Yeah.
Truly fascinating.
Good.
Final thought.
I guess I just want to reiterate that I think it's time to really consider some of our reachable friends that are Democrats and say, you know, point out some of the dangers that exist. We've always had, you know, going back decades, the fear, oh, well, this reds under the bed scare is just that. This is just McCarthyism. It's not McCarthyism. This is real. And if they are skilled at power politics, reasonable people in the center don't think about how to seize control of institutions, but radicals do. And it does not take a majority. There was only 4 or 5% of people in Germany that were party officials within the Nazi party. It only takes a minority to seize control. And if they do, things can get ugly quickly. So my appeal is, let's be reasonable and reach across with people that are also reasonable, even if they don't share our exact politics.
Well, Stephen Peck, thank you so much. Very interesting podcast. So thank you.
Thank you.
And my friends, God bless you and God bless America.